First, though, it's time for Correspondence Report with Thomas Ariti.
Thanks, Hugh. Welcome to the program. If you've been following the ABC's international news and current affairs coverage in recent years, chances are you'd know the name Lisa Miller. Lisa's our London bureau chief, and she's covered everything from terrorist attacks to royal weddings. Before that, she was our North America correspondent. In fact, she completed two stints in Washington. But now it's time to head home, and time for Lisa Miller to reflect on an extraordinary 9 years abroad.
At the time, it felt like the biggest screw-up of my career. Terrorists had shot dead 130 people in Paris late one Friday. I was a brand new bureau chief in London, trying to get my head around the biggest breaking story in the world that night. It was too late for the Eurostar or any flights, so we drove for 2 hours to Dover in a desperate bid to catch the 2 a.m. ferry. There were three of us, Phil Williams, myself, and cameraman Alessandro Pavoni. We calculated if we drove through the night, we'd make it to Paris by 9 a.m, in time for the all-important 7 p.m. television news bulletin. We made it to Dover on the English coastline, where French immigration officials approached our car. Phil turned back towards me and said, "They want our passports." Passport? Mine was in a handbag near my desk in London, left behind when at the last minute I'd switched everything to a bigger backpack. There was only one decision that could be made. Phil and Alessandro kept heading for Paris, and I, unfortunately, ended up being detained by French officials. Borders were being shut down and all of Europe was on edge. Who was this woman thinking she could waltz into a terror zone without identification? They kept me for what felt like an hour before asking me to sign a four-page document in French. For all I knew, it could have precluded me from ever entering France again. But I was beyond caring. I was mentally writing off my career. The rest of the night was a blur. I found a minicab driver who agreed to get me back to London for £120, cash up front. My hands were shaking so much I mis-entered the ATM pin twice and was at risk of being cashless and completely stranded. As dawn broke, I was on a plane to Paris with the rest of the team, and when we joined Phil Williams there, he assured me no one would remember my failings. He was right. Sometimes you screw up, but you just have to get on with it. This is the moment police take down a suspect. As I reflect on the highlights and lowlights of these past 9 years abroad as an ABC foreign correspondent, these are the moments I think of. Not the presidential campaigns or royal weddings, although they are exciting to cover, but the stories behind the stories. Simply getting to the starting line can often be the biggest challenge. I remember vividly September the 8th, 2001, getting the call that I'd be posted to the US.
What are those people going to do? All the elevators are blocked out.
Oh my God, so both towers are now...
I arrived 3 months later. The World Trade Center was still burning. As I wind up my time in London, terrorism has been a familiar and a traumatizing theme. January the 1st, 2017, started with a phone call waking me at 1:59 a.m. I know the exact time because I kept the screenshot as a reminder. I'd been so sure that there'd be an attack of some sort, I went to bed early. A gunman had killed 39 people at a nightclub in Istanbul, and producer Emily Street had booked myself and cameraman Niall Lenehan on a 6 a.m. flight. Turkey wasn't normally in our patch, but when you're the closest on-duty correspondent, you're the next one up. Do we need visas? Can we get our camera gear in there without customs papers? I asked. I rattled off questions but had no idea the biggest hurdle would be trying to get a cab in London on New Year's Eve to get to the office.
Good morning, this is AM. I'm Kim Landers. First, there's still no clear indication of who was responsible for a gun attack in an Istanbul nightclub which killed 39 people on New Year's Eve. Europe correspondent Lisa Miller is outside the nightclub in Istanbul.
It's late evening, Kim, and the police are still guarding the...
We were home from that Turkey assignment in 3 days. It was a new year, but I had a new problem. I opened the door and remembered I'd left the heating on in the middle of winter, and I'd cooked fish for dinner the night I'd rushed out the door. I sat on the couch and debated whether to laugh or cry. I had the same reaction when a viewer criticised me for wearing the same black jacket each day during the 2015 Paris attacks. Huh? I'd tweeted back at him. He doubled down, telling me to go shopping. Funnily enough, I didn't have time to shop. Mental note to self, pack better when covering breaking news tragedies, I tweeted, not thinking for a second I was starting what would become a global online debate about how women and men are treated differently on television. I knocked back an interview request from New York and said we needed to remember what we were doing in Paris, covering a real story. The middle-of-the-night calls are part of the job when you work for an Australian organisation in a different time zone, but at times, they were relentless. I anticipated them so keenly that I'd answer the phone on the first ring with, "What's happened?" My personal best for going from fast asleep at home to being on air for ABC News was 28 minutes. Another Australian avoided injury. Their attacker had been silent and lethal. Police believe it was spontaneous, his victims chosen randomly.
A guy just come running, desperate, with a knife and stabbing people like that.
There'd been a stabbing in Russell Square in London and Australians had been hurt. I woke at 2 a.m, called a cab, applied makeup on the way in, read Twitter and had producers in Sydney briefing me on the phone before running into the office, flicking on the studio and the remote camera and starting to talk. My favourite down days involve... no talking. My sleep has been utterly woeful. I'd wake with a start in the middle of the night, convinced the silent phone half a metre from my head had been ringing. One night I was so desperate for a full 8 hours sleep, I guiltily swallowed a sleeping pill at 11 p.m, just as a news alert lit up my phone screen. Up to 70 monks shot dead in terror attack in southern France. My colleague Steve Kinane was getting ready for bed on the other side of London. I rang him. Steve, listen carefully, I said, apparently. I've just taken a sleeping tablet and 70 monks could be dead, and you've got to ring Sydney and work out how to get there in time, and you'll have to tell Niall to get the gear and pack and... zzz. I was asleep. Thankfully, it was a false alarm. Although terror and grief have dominated my time overseas, it's always been a privilege to be allowed into people's lives. Viewers move on from stories, but I've had the privilege to return to some of them. I will always admire the strength and wisdom of Veronique Posner, whose son Noah was killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting, and who continues to this day her fight for gun reform. And I will always remember the Colasanti family. I first met Kelly Colasanti and her infant daughters Lauren and Cara in 2002. 9 years later, I was in their Manhattan home, at the end of a school day, listening to Lauren, now 11, reciting the names of people who died on September 11th.
Lise Connolly. James Lee.
She was rehearsing
Connor
for the 10-year remembrance service. The final name on her list? Christopher Michael Colasanti, her dad.
Connors. And my father, Christopher Michael Colasanti.
Okay, don't read it so slow.
Don't rush through that one.
Don't rush through that one, Kelly, her mum said, as her daughter's voice dropped. Could you do it again? Her mum quietly asked her, wanting her late husband's name to be heard. We stood back in the shadows of the lounge room, capturing this intimate moment. As she repeated,
"And my father, Christopher Michael Colasanti."
What a privilege to have been there.
Lisa Miller signing off from our London Bureau. And Lisa, congratulations on your years of hard work. Well, moving from departures to arrivals now, after 3 years in Indonesia, the ABC's new Middle East correspondent, Adam Harvey, is on the ground in Beirut. Here's some first impressions of his new home.
When I told my friends I was moving to Jakarta, a typical reaction was, right, Jakarta. Well, it's good for your career. Do you want to catch up in Singapore? I've heard Lombok's good. After 3 years in the Indonesian capital, I can safely say they were right. Beirut provokes a different reaction. Either enthusiasm, as in, my God, the clubs, I had the greatest night of my life in Beirut. Or dread, thanks to 4 decades of bad PR, broadcast globally.
This was once the richest part of the richest city in the Middle East. Now it's the front line of the war in the Lebanon.
So I was expecting the bullet-pitted buildings and scarred landmarks like downtown's Holiday Inn. I wasn't expecting Beirut's sheen or the style. The downtown shopping district of the Beirut souks is as glossy as any European capital. It was heavily shelled during the Civil War and bombed by the Israelis, and the rebuild is immaculate. The hip furniture stores and high-end boutiques leave Sydney and Melbourne for dead, if you could afford to shop there. The Beirutis in the souks, though, aren't constrained by something as mundane as price. Judging by the number of streamlined noses and swollen upper lips, they've plenty of cash to spread around. The economy here, apparently, is tanking, but you wouldn't know it from the stores selling $400 chairs and $80 plates. It's searingly hot right now, so I popped into an outdoor store to buy a plain cap and reversed out just as quickly when I read the price tag, $75. Sitting down for lunch threatens a bill that can easily touch $50. I've learned my lesson. Just like in Paris, eat and drink standing up. The poverty is on show as much as the wealth. That's largely because there's an estimated 1.5 million Syrian refugees here, and just 4.5 million Lebanese. And in the district where I live, in West Beirut, each street seems to have 3 or 4 young beggars. One of the young Syrian boys stood next to my car as I sat in the driver's seat, thumbing through Google Maps to try and navigate my way out of the West Beirut labyrinth. He stood beside my window, tapping on the glass. Please, money, thank you, money. I didn't have any cash, and he wasn't going anywhere. Tap, tap, tap. Please, money, thank you, money. It felt like 10 minutes, it was probably just 5. But eventually, as I was getting no closer to finding my way out, I lost my temper, shouting at him to go away through the glass, and I still feel awful about it. There's another boy who sleeps on the narrow footpath outside my apartment. He's usually asleep when I leave in the morning, laid out on his side on a couple of thin pieces of cardboard, his feet bare and his arm thrown over his face to block out the sun and the stares of the passers-by who must step over him to get past. Shireen, the ABC's producer here in Beirut, contacted a child welfare organisation to see if they could help. It took a couple of weeks, but eventually someone came to talk to him. He's not Syrian. He's Lebanese. He's 15 years old, the same age as my eldest boy, and from a town about 2 hours' drive away. He has a difficult relationship with his parents, who are divorced. He says neither wants him with them. He sleeps on the footpath during the day because he's frightened of what might happen at night. The police and the welfare workers took him back to his dad's home. And then, 3 days later, he returned. This morning he was there again, sleeping on the cardboard outside our apartment as the perpetual traffic jam slowly crawled past. The traffic is gridlocked here a lot of the day. When it moves, though, it's worse. Forget reporting from conflict zones. The most dangerous thing I will do in the Middle East is to enter the Lebanese traffic. We drove to the Bekaa Valley during the week, up and over a steep mountain range. It's a 4-lane highway, which in most countries would mean 2 lanes each way. But in Lebanon, as you rounded each bend, you never knew how many lanes of oncoming traffic you'd find. And all this at 80 kilometres an hour. I survived the Bekaa road trip and made it back to Beirut, where the stalled afternoon traffic in the city's west was fine by me. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for Correspondence Report.
It's probably the most difficult place to report in China. In the far western province of Xinjiang, the Chinese are conducting a campaign to smash Islamic extremism and independence sentiments. It's home to about 11 million Uyghurs, an ethnic minority who practice the Islamic faith, and many are now describing what's happening there as the biggest crackdown on any ethnic group in the world today. Human rights activists say wide-scale abuses and mass detainments are taking place. But the Chinese deny this and don't like foreign reporters going to see for themselves. China correspondent Matthew Carney went to the region for the Foreign Correspondent Program. Here's his journal of what happened.
It was midnight and I was in a deep sleep after travelling all day to get to Kashgar. The phone rang in my hotel room and suddenly I jolted upright. My Chinese colleague was at the other end of the line saying, "They're here. They want to see us downstairs now." Downstairs in the hotel lounge, there were five people waiting for us. Two of them, Max and Mike, as they called themselves, said in perfect English, "Welcome to Kashgar." I did point out to them that it was midnight and it wasn't a very nice welcome. Max replied, "We're just doing our job. We want to show you how peaceful and harmonious Kashgar really is." And that was quickly followed up with a threat. If we filmed any police or security presence, any surveillance technology, then our journalist visas might be cancelled. Over the course of the next 4 days, we learnt there was a much bigger cordon of more than 20 security officials watching us 24 hours a day. And the three ladies from the propaganda department who never left our side would ensure locations were cleaned before we turned up, so everything appeared to look peaceful and harmonious. It was difficult to speak with any local Uyghurs, and when we did, it was all set up. So they'd talk about the wonderful development China was providing. This man, a shopkeeper at the Grand Bazaar, was briefed by our minders for 15 minutes before he said this.
"Under the leadership of Xi Jinping, life is getting better all the time. We now have good roads and good buildings, even trains and aeroplanes. Life just gets better and better."
Many in the US Congress, and now the United Nations, say China's campaign in Xinjiang is the worst persecution against any ethnic group in the world today. And China is putting serious money behind its campaign. Last year, they spent a whopping $12 billion, an increase of tenfold over the last decade. If you are Han Chinese, you are deemed trustworthy and are free to move. But if you are a Uyghur, you are immediately under suspicion and put into the questionable category, simply because of your ethnicity. Your movements are restricted. The United Nations says it has credible evidence that about 1 million Uyghurs, about 10% of their population, are now being held in detention without trial in re-education camps. China denies this and says they only detain convicted terrorists and conduct vocational training. Testimonies of former inmates are starting to emerge, and they say they're forced to denounce their religion and culture and embrace Communist Party ideology. If they don't, they claim they're tortured and put into solitary confinement. They call them concentration camps. We spoke to Tahir Hamat, a Uyghur filmmaker and poet in America.
"The concentration camps are very congested and overpopulated with detainees. They're forced to study political propaganda for 12 hours a day. The food, drinking water and living conditions are very poor."
When the Chinese authorities learned that Tahir Hamat had fled to America, his brothers and two brothers-in-law disappeared.
"It's impossible to communicate with them. They're in concentration camps. Even to contact their families, their wives, isn't possible now."
Kashgar is meant to be the spiritual heartland of the Uyghurs. The Chinese have rebuilt one section of the city and turned it into a kind of Uyghur theme park, mainly for Chinese tourists, where you can try the local cuisine, buy some trinkets, and see a show. One got the impression that the Chinese in Xinjiang were very much trying to smash Uyghur culture and rebuild and reshape it in their own image. Just before we left, there was one more cameo. When we sat down in our seats in the plane back to Beijing, a tall, older gentleman approached us dressed as a flight attendant. He stood in front of us with a camera attached to his chest and recorded us for a few seconds. Then he left. This is Matthew Carney for Correspondence Report in Kashgar, Xinjiang Province, China.
And you can catch more of Matthew Carney's report on Foreign Correspondent this Tuesday night at 8 on ABC TV and online. That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Thomas Ariti. My thanks to technical producer Mariam Zahr. Join us at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's Foreign Correspondents. Now it's back to you, Hugh.
Thank you, Thomas.